between what you see and what I see lies reality.
Calgary Show Services presents the Event Planning Podcast, featuring interviews with industry professionals to help you produce your next event.
All right. I'm with Caitlin Brown in her backyard, and it's lovely. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rec City, tell me about it.
So Rec City is now a curatorial collective. So there are seven of us as of yesterday, who are involved in Rec City. So I'm one of seven co-curators of Rec City, but it began as an event, which you probably saw. Did you come to Rec City proper?
Yep.
Which was in Sunnyside, and that was 9 houses, 3 garages, and a greenhouse that were scheduled for demolition. And Brandon Dahmer, who is your cousin, lived in one of those houses. And he helped co-run 809, which was a garage-based gallery space. 809, I think, it filled this really interesting niche, sort of between art school and everything else. And that's not to say that there weren't non-emerging artists that were showing in 809, but there were certainly a lot of artists that came straight from ACAD or even were still attending the college and were showing new works like installations and sculptures and paintings and drawings and anything you can possibly imagine in this garage. Yeah, and that space was open. It was open initially for 809 days, and the address was 809, so all of these 809s. And then it closed for a couple years, and then Brandon and Sean Minkowski opened it up again, basically to host a residency for maybe about a year and a half. But then they found out that the block surrounding 809 was being demolished. And they were thinking about ways to sort of eulogize the space, but also they were thinking about different projects that have used domestic spaces or have used alternative spaces and used them as installation or gallery spaces. So I had been involved in a project called the House Project, which was actually pretty close to here also. It was one house that was scheduled for demolition, and there were 8 artists, and we transformed the building, you know, kind of ripped it apart, learned a lot about how not to disturb hazardous materials, how to avoid molds, et cetera, et cetera, but also the potential of what you can do with a house if you're given full rein to mess it up completely and irreparably. So they thought about me, and they thought about John Frost from the Arbor Lake School Collective, which is school with a G, S-G-H-O-O-L, which was a collective that was in the suburbs of Calgary and Arbor Lake, and continues to function outside of the suburbs. That house is long gone, but it was a house that was essentially subverting the suburbs. Really amazing stuff, like 2-story cardboard mountains. They had a dump truck load of sand dumped on the front yard so it could be a beach for a Choose Your Own Adventure Fest 1 year. They had trench warfare in the backyard where they reenacted trench warfare with water balloons and dug trenches into the yard in the burbs, which did not please their neighbors.
I bet.
So John and Andrew Frost are brothers that were both involved in the Arbor Lake School, and they became part of Rec City Collective. Mark Bore, he's actually overseas now going to grad school, but he was running a garage-based gallery space called Hate Gallery. And then who am I forgetting? Jennifer Crichton. Jennifer Crichton was involved in... She's a musician. She plays in Devonian Gardens. You probably know her, actually.
Yep.
Yeah, Jen's pretty amazing. Hermitess. But she was involved in a number of other things, too, leading up to that. Like, her and Laura Leaf and some other folks had... Oh, I'm forgetting the name of the project that they were working on, but it was essentially very domestic and feminine. So like alternative spaces again were really important to them. And we now, Rec City has another member, Natalie McLean, who was an artist at Rec City proper. She came in from Toronto to participate and then sort of fell in love with the city and Sean Minkowski and ended up moving here. Long story short, we're a medley of misfits. With a lot of kind of strange experiences that coalesce into something hopefully greater than the sum of its parts.
So what are some of the experiences that the collective is putting on?
But we have had 3 major events, and then we've built 1 sculpture together. So Rec City proper, which was sort of what I told you about, and then Phantom Wing, which was in a pre-demolition wing of the old King Edward School, which is currently being renovated to be part of it's C space. Like, it's an arts incubator space, which will have a series of arts organizations sort of living in parts of this old sandstone school. But before they renovated to become this this giant, like, new theater space, like new rental facilities, they had a wing, like a 1960s wing of this school, that was quite severely flood damaged and very asbestos-y. And they gave it to Rec City to put on another project. So the first project, the first of three, had about 150 artists involved. The second project had about 35. And then the third, which was last summer, was called Demo Tape, and it was in the old Penguin Car Wash, which was supposed to be demolished but hasn't been. So that building is still standing, which is really interesting in terms of how you think about the concept of Rec City, to have a building that actually is still standing and still has quite a bit of art inside it from Demo Tape that hasn't been destroyed, you know, and is now slowly being archived.
What is that like, the experience of having your work just disappearing?
I think that's an interesting question, and it's one we're asked quite a lot. I think all the artists, like, I wouldn't presume to speak for the artists themselves, because I think all of them have quite different perspectives on it. But as one of the curators, it is something that's incredibly freeing, actually, to know that your work, you know, doesn't need to exist forever.
I imagine it would allow for a certain amount of experimentation, because it is something temporary. So knowing that it's only going to exist for a small amount of time,
yeah,
you've already kind of let it go in your mind. So
yeah,
it's not as harmful to experiment with it.
Yeah, no, totally. That's true, certainly. And then I think for the viewer, it allows the viewer to be an experimental looker in a lot of ways, because they know that, you know, that the space itself is not intended to be permanent, that there's, you know, that there's a conversation to be had about impermanence that's inherent in the work itself. And that was very obvious with Rec City proper. Like, it was a whole, you know, it was 9 houses. It was actually 11 houses. There were 2 houses on the block that weren't directly involved in Rec City, but it was 11 houses that were going to be demolished, and there was a new condo building that was going to be built in its space. So Rec City became that sort of bridge in terms of conversation about what has been in a neighborhood and what will be, and maybe in an imaginative space, like, what could be or what should be, if that makes sense.
So what is involved in curating an event like that?
Well, this is the crux of it, isn't it? Event planning podcast. Oh man, it's crazy different every time. For the first Rec City, we had very little experience actually convincing a space to let us occupy it and partially, you know, destroy it in a artistic way. So I mean that in terms of, like, cutting holes in walls and ceilings and floors and doing so safely. So safely, I mean, like, structurally, but also safely for the artists and for the viewers. So knowing where the asbestos is, knowing where the lead paint is, and knowing where, you know, where there are potential problems. So probably the first step is identifying a space that's too good to let slide. You know what I mean? So, like, for Rec City, that's typically meant an empty or forgotten space, like an abandoned building, or although we're not exclusively tied to buildings. Like, if there was an interesting enough non-building based space, that would be great. But usually it's finding the space, figuring out who owns it, approaching that group or person, giving them information about ourselves. And it helps to have a track record now. You know, we know that there were 10,000 people at Rec City. We know that there were 3,500 people at Phantom Wing. We know that there are about 3,500 at Demo Tape. So we can say, you know, like, we have attendance. The 8 of us have history as artists. We've toured art around the world. We've run festivals. You know, we've worked for the city of Calgary. You know, like, there's experience there. So it's not like they're just trusting sort of like an invisible entity. And then comes this sort of the finesse of trying to convince someone that there's value in letting their space become something else temporarily before it's not
what
there
is
at
the
all.
Value?
I think that is a really that's a loaded question that I shouldn't have pushed in your lap.
You fell right into
it's
it.
It's funny. Someone asked me that today. Like, what in your opinion is the value of art? And they were asking this
that's
was on the internet.
Two in the morning conversation.
Oh yeah. Well, and I think that there, it's necessarily a flexible value. You know, like that value changes all the time and it needs to be changeable. And they were asking because there was an article in The Guardian recently that was talking about how, you know, there's this assumption that art is really positive for neighborhoods that are in distress or for socially bringing groups closer together. Or, you know, like there's this like cultural capital idea, like the like Richard Florida kind of stuff. And all of that is... it's very necessarily tied to this sort of capitalist thought of what value is and can be. Whereas I think of art as like, you know, what's the value of a library? You know, like if you tried to tie the immediate value of a library into like the value that it has for a community, I mean, maybe you could say like, oh, it teaches people how to read and they can get better jobs or whatever. But like, I think ultimately the value of art is intangible and it's not quantifiable in the way that we think about quantity. You know, there's like quantity and quality. And for us, like we can say like Rec City has... you know, directly engage thousands of Calgarians in an art viewing experience. But I don't think it's the quantity that is as valuable as the quality of those engagements or like the people that's sort of catalyzed some sort of epiphany for or maybe some sort of new way of looking at the world, you know. And I'm sure my co-curators would have a much more eloquent way of addressing that.
No, it makes sense completely. It's exactly like just having this podcast existing for me. Every single person that I've spoken to, I take away something from it in a new way of thinking or something else to explore. And how can you quantify something like that? It's like an experience that just like events are, like going to a music show or something like that. You're having an experience of a new way of looking at something or a contradictory impression of something. And yeah. then you take that and you interact with other people with that in your mind. Like, so it's not only the person who's individually experiencing it, they're casting that light onto everything that they contribute to, every conversation that they contribute to. Because it exists within them.
Kind of. It's part of their repertoire. Well, and the other thing that I think is really interesting is that what you take away from something is completely different than what someone else would take away from something, or than what I would take away from something, you know? Like there's a... I think there's this artist that I have a crazy boner for named Oliver Eliasson. Really amazing work. He's based out of Germany. But he has this sort of thought that reality is the intersecting between circles on a Venn diagram. So this thin sliver, you know, between our shared perceptions. And that is probably the value of anything, or at least the quantifiable value of anything is that thin sliver, whereas the actual wider resonance of that thing stretches far beyond that, if that makes sense.
What is the artist's name again?
Oliver Eliasson. I'm probably poorly pronouncing his name. He makes
something to
work.
Google.
Yeah.
So tell me about Incandescent Cloud.
Yeah, so Cloud is a work that I made in collaboration with Wayne Garrett, who's in the house somewhere hiding. It's a work that we made for Nuit Blanche Calgary in 2012, and it was made out of 6,000 incandescent light bulbs, burnt out and new, and they sort of make a diffusion layer in the same way that a cloud would diffuse sunlight. They diffuse in between what you see and what I see lies reality, and it's 100 LED light bulbs that are each controlled by a pole switch, which looks like rain underneath the clouds. So if enough people are interacting with the work, which is interactive, it's a light work that's interactive, then it looks like lightning is flickering on the outside of the piece. Yeah, so that's physically what Cloud is about. But I think if you begin to sort of break down the meanings within that piece, it's much more about social interaction and engagement with strangers and looking at familiar materials in a different light. those kind of understandings.
And when you toured it, when being the artist and you're dealing with logistics from your end, like how do we get this fragile thing from one venue to the next? What was your experience like working with other curators putting on events that you would be displaying that
in? Yeah. Like I feel like that reciprocal relationship is really interesting, to be a sort of DIY curator and then to also work as an artist with curators, and hopefully one makes the other better in terms of my personal experience. So Cloud is still touring. We have three editions of that piece. One, the Calgary-based work is right now in Minneapolis at Wiseman Art Museum, which is, you know, it's a really cool space, but that was probably fairly painless because it was museum. So they have a really excellent curatorial team, an amazing technical team. They have what's called a registrar, which is someone who ensures that the work essentially looks the exact same when it was received as when it leaves the museum. So they ensure quality. And that includes with things like shipping. Like if they, for example, have an Andy Warhol show, the registrar would make sure that they have climate controlled trucks, kind of thing, transporting that work from point A to point B, and that all of their, you know, like liability insurance is in place. Like all of those sort of logistical concerns are taken care of by the registrar. In terms of our experience touring our second edition of the work, which we built in Russia, and then it's that piece is still a crazy thing. That piece has no home. So we built it in Moscow, and then we essentially bribed, or at least this is our understanding, is that it was a bribe to Russian customs to permanently export the work, because even though we owned it, because we built it in Russia, there are all these import-export logistics, which are not something that we had any idea about when we built this piece. You know, and it is quite large, as you say, and delicate in its own way, though also much stronger than you would think, considering it's made out of light bulbs. The steel subframe is pretty strong. But so that piece is still touring, and every country it's imported into and exported from, there are different concerns. So that piece showed in Jerusalem at a light festival there, which is a really interesting light festival, really interesting city. Like you really... I still feel like we're, you know, just tip of the iceberg in terms of our understanding of places that old and with that much, you know, layered history and controversy and contention. But the imports into that place were really quite a bit more problematic than, you know, importing something into the EU, for example, just in terms of like they have crazy tariffs and all of that. I feel like I'm just like talking in a giant circle around this piece. It is a problematic, ginormous piece that is very heavy and extremely expensive to ship. It needs, it needs to have trucks that have air ride suspension so that it doesn't shake itself apart when it's being transported from point A to point B. But ultimately, Cloud is magical in the sense that it has built-in redundancies. So because the work is made out of 6,000 pieces, if 10 or 100 of them break, we replace them. And in the same sense, like with the pull string switches, like those break every festival. You know, we have been at festivals where there were 300,000 people in a weekend, and the piece is just torn apart, and we just fix it the next morning. You know, like it's not our favorite thing to do, but redundancy is actually really a great way of ensuring that work has a certain degree of quality over time, but can still be touched. You know?
Mm-hmm. That's tricky because like, most pieces are probably not as interactive as something like that. So it has this whole other layer of considerations.
Yeah. But they are mass-produced parts. So they're readily available, which is helpful too. Not something redesigned, mind you, but it's come in handy.
What is one of the most challenging things that you've come across in curating events?
During demo tape, so that was the exhibition we curated in an old car wash. That was over the summer, and it was opening with Sled Island, so it was sort of like arm's reach from Sled Island, but in collaboration with Sled Island. We had the June rains, of course, which have been the bane of Calgary's existence in previous years. And the car wash was at this point full of artwork. We were almost opening. There was a beautiful piece by Ben Nixon and Rochelle, I forget her last name right now, Quinn. And they had built this like gorgeous keyboard powered light installation and all these like handmade paper flowers, just this like beautiful installation. And then it began raining. And it rained and it rained and it rained. And we thought that the building would be fairly all right, but it's a car wash. And so no one has ever fixed a leak in that building, because why would they?
You know?
It's based around water.
Yeah.
And the more water, the merrier. And the roof began leaking into their space.
Oh,
and
no.
It over the course of several hours, like I went to check on that piece in the morning and it was leaking a little bit. And then we came back in the afternoon. Actually, Ben and Rochelle came back in the afternoon and it was like a torrential downpour right into their $1,000 worth of many thousands of dollars worth of equipment. And they were pretty cool considering the situation. They were pretty awesome. They were understandably upset.
Yeah,
and that's not something that I personally have the capability of dealing with. But luckily, Andrew Frost and Matthew Boré both have some experience, at least, in problem solving of this sort. And so they built a makeshift sort of aqueduct out of wood and thick plastic to sort of direct this torrential downpour into another, you know, like outside of the building. And then Rochelle and Ben erected a tent in the space. So it, like, there's a lot of negotiation. And I think the biggest problems with Rec City, at least, have been in negotiating spaces that we have no history with and they're old, you know, and they're rickety and sometimes they're literally falling apart. But that's also, you know, that's the value of working in these spaces.
What it's
yeah.
about.
Yeah, is coming into a space that's dirtied by its own history and then responding to that history. And that hoping that the work doesn't tear itself apart before the public at least gets a chance to look at it.
What about a fond memory?
There are a lot of those. I don't even think I can begin to touch on how wonderful that first sort of experience of Rec City proper when that whole neighborhood was open to the public, even before the neighborhood was open to the public. Yeah. You essentially are making a neighborhood of artists, you know, and like we try to include people that we don't know already in all of our projects. So we'll do some amount of direct curating where we, and this isn't true of every project. Usually we have a call for submissions, but for the first Rec City, we asked a certain number of people specifically to be part of Rec City. And then we also accepted a call for submissions. And so there was a possibility for like people we had never met before becoming part of this temporary community. And that was really an amazing experience, like building all the work together and spending about a month, you know, on and off, like various people coming and going, like when they had time because they didn't know whether or not they'd be paid, you know, like we lived it up to our artists how much they can commit in terms of time, just because, you know, like we're not giving them nearly as much as they deserve. Nowhere, you know, like a couple hundred to $1,000. Like that's pretty much our budget range. And to expect someone to put in, people put in a lot. You know, like they put in a lot of their own time and their own resources and their own mental and emotional energy. And we want to respect the space that they need to make that whatever work they're making. But there are these really magical moments, I think, for all of us when we're working and you look around and you realize that everyone around you are probably the best friends that you'll ever have. And that they're all pursuing something, some sort of ethereal, intangible value that you also find valuable. That is this sort of like interspace between you. And that's probably my favorite part, is just like that moment when everyone's working and, you know, the work is maybe far from being done and it still seems impossible, but you know that you have the whole community around you supporting you and making this impossible thing. And then ultimately the second moment is like when that impossible thing is realized and the public gets to walk in and see it.
When you mentioned the money, I was wondering where the funding is coming from for the artists.
Yeah. So first Rec City, we were really fortunate in having a huge amount of people give us money on a crowdfunding campaign. That was really amazing, especially when we got, you know, like $1,000 from a name that none of us recognized. Like that was really pretty inspiring, actually, to see people sort of investing money. We also were given some money by the development company, like $2,500 from the development company. We applied for a grant to the Alberta Foundation for the Arts, which we received, but we applied for it basically right before Rec City began. So we didn't know that we had that funding in place until far after the project was over. So when we began the first Rec City project, we basically made it clear to all the artists that they might not be paid. And so they should use as much free material as possible. That's the pile of junk you see in our backyard. Lane Shorty is probably my favorite sort of found material artist in Calgary, certainly. And then we retroactively paid everybody $225, which was pretty good considering there were like 160 artists. And I mean, anyway, so the money is complicated. For projects since then, so for the project called Phantom Wing, C-Space basically funded that project, and they also paid a photographer to document the work. Yeah, so they gave us that was actually really wonderful. That allowed us to work on a much tighter timeline. So we had confirmed funding in place, and then we could figure out how many artists to give funding to and just how to work with that. And then for the most recent project, Demo Tape, we had funding from Alberta Foundation for the Arts and Canada Council for the Arts. So, I mean, we find money where we find money. We, in talking about another project, I think we'll probably look into granting again. It's important to find sponsorship as well. We're not very good at that yet. I don't think people have offered to give us money, and we're like, yeah, in the future maybe, but what do you want in exchange? Because I think it's quite important for us to make sure that we understand what sort of anchors come with any amount of dollars that we're given, so that A, we're not being bought by some corporate entity that might have expectations that we can't put in place, and B, so that we maintain above all our creative autonomy, and then by trickle down, the creative autonomy of the artists that we're working with.
Very interesting. That's crazy. It seems like there's already a community in place. So like, usually I'd ask about volunteers and things like this, but it seems like the community, there's already an intrinsic value in it. Like the art and the community is the reward, and people are willing to give their time to it, like without another incentive, it seems.
That's really interesting that you're saying that. And I feel like ultimately that's true, that the community is the reward for the artists, and that we try and pay them because we realize that, you know, community won't pay your rent. As much as you wish it would, but the relationships that you make might allow you then to make new work in the future.
For sure.
Yeah.
Once you have the event in place and the artists are already established and the work is done, how do you promote the event?
Yeah. So promotion, we've gone out of our way not to spend too much money on that, because any money that we have, we want to make sure gets given directly to the artists as much as possible. So usually we print a bunch of posters, a bunch of cards. Facebook is a really amazing tool. Twitter, Instagram, word of mouth is of course always the biggest one. You know, for Rec City, I feel like we have all these artists that are telling their friends, that are telling their families. Sled Island, when we worked Demo Tape, Sled Island had a huge role in co-promoting kind of that event. The other thing is that we always try and make sure that there are some live events too. So whether that's performance art or bands, bands are really, I think people underestimate the value of having various bands play at art shows, because A, like it is this really tangible reason for coming to a thing, but also bands have their own audiences. And I think in sharing those audiences, you come away with a whole new understanding of what your event was about. So for example, at Phantom Wing, we had, I'm not going to say the band's name, but they were like pretty punk rock. And their audience was all just like a bunch of like skeezy teens who like tried to steal art and like spilt wine on some of the installations, but they also had like a really amazing fresh perspective and way of looking at the art, and that was pretty awesome to see, even though it was like kind of like we basically had to kick them out of the
challenging
building.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on, please leave, don't
that
do
kind
that.
Of
this is
that
art.
Informs the artist too of what what impression their work is making on a different demographic.
Yeah, and what memories are sticking with people too. Like experiential work, like Rec City, where you actually come into a space and you might stay there for the whole afternoon and like see a band and like see a talk and, you know, like play with the art or, you know, like kind of break it by accident or whatever. Like that's a completely different way of thinking about art than going to a lot of White Cube gallery shows where you're like seeing a painting on a wall and maybe having a glass of wine.
It's a bit more passive.
Yeah, it is more passive. Like, I think we really like that active engagement or that possibility that there is a conversation. Like, it's not just, you're not just coming to look, like, you're coming to respond and, like, be co-responded to. And that, you know, together you're sort of negotiating an understanding of what that work is about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you're on a desert island and you could only have one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, man. I don't know. There's probably something really practical that you could ask for, like watermelon. I don't know. How long would I live?
Does it, that depends would it be on what you choose, I think.
Power bars. I don't know. Probably mint chocolate chip ice cream.
I don't think you're going to live very long, but it would be a happy last few days. Yeah. Well, thank you. Oh, well, where can people find out about you and what you're doing?
Yeah. So for Rec City stuff, you can go to our website, which is now reccity.ca. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter. Facebook is probably the most active space because we are in between projects and we have no idea what we'll be doing next. Like, we just have no idea. Probably we will be doing something. I cannot promise that, but I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that a space or two come through. For me, I work primarily with my collaborator, Wayne, and you can find me on incandescentcloud.com, or you can find us under Caitlin Brown and Wayne Garrett on Facebook.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for interviewing me.
Cheers.
Random things.
Right on.
Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Duncan Kenworthy, Eric Jesse, and Chris Benoit. Visit us online at calgaryshowservices.com to join our monthly newsletter for inventory updates and event insights.